Welcome to EIR Talks. On February 16, 2002, EIR's founding editor, Lyndon H. LaRouche, addressed the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute and International Caucus of Labor Committees. Over 1,000 people were in attendance. This week we bring you the first part of LaRouche's opening address entitled, Is Enron Cluster's Last Stand? Next Comes the Cluster Bust.
Thank you. We've come to a momentous weekend, as I promised you when I issued the title for today's remarks. The Enron crisis would be Cluster's last stand. That we are now on the weekend of the great Cluster Buster, the day that the walls fall down. Not that the falling is completed today, but to many people around the world who are paying attention, it's obvious that this financial system as a whole is in the process of disintegrating. Now, the significance of my saying that is the fact that I've been saying that for some time, that this was inevitable. I said it in particular in August of 1971, when a forecast I had made 10 years or 11 years earlier came true, that during the second half of the 1960s, as I had forecast, the world financial system would go through a series of monetary crises, which, unless the appropriate response were made, these crises would lead to a breakdown of the post-war Bretton Woods system. And what happened on mid-August 1971 was a breakdown of the world monetary system as it existed at that time. I said in response to the confirmation of that forecast that this meant that the United States and the world were faced with a choice. That 1971 would be the beginning of a process of disintegration of the U.S. and world economy as a whole. And that unless certain changes were made from the policies which the Nixon administration typified at that time, that this would lead to the alternative of fascism. As of September 11th, and looking at the events of September 11th and what's behind them, we are at the edge of fascism globally, right now. September 11th was an expression of that. It had two aspects to it, actually three. One aspect, there was a coup. As experts know, this coup was not done by Osama bin Laden, or by anybody from that part of the world. It could not have been done. Technically, it could not have happened. As anybody who knows anything about security systems, as I came to become somewhat of an expert in this back during the SDI days, it could not happen in the United States unless there was calculated vast negligence or deliberate orchestration or a combination of both. However, there is something in the United States which has been heavily operative since about 1960, which began earlier inside the U.S. military and other institutions. And this was a movement to overturn the U.S. tradition, including its military tradition, including the military tradition we associate with General of the Armies Douglas MacArthur during World War II, and what we associate with Eisenhower as commander-in-chief of U.S. forces in Europe during World War II. The firing of MacArthur was one of the first steps toward that, toward a new kind of conception of warfare. Instead of resolving the crisis in Korea, We protracted the Korean War, which in effect is continuing still today, which the present administration is trying to reactivate today as a stepping stone toward a strategic confrontation with China. What happened in Korea, in the protracted war in Korea, became a model for what's called the Vietnam War, the U.S. war in Indochina, a protracted no-win war, a type contrary to all American military doctrine, but other things were happening at the same time. What was replacing the MacArthur's, the West Point tradition, and similar kinds of things which were U.S. military standards before? What happened was there's a group in the United States, partly in the military, and concentrated in certain think tanks, which have used as their model of their goal for the conduct of conflict is the model of the Nazi Waffen-SS. The Nazi Waffen-SS, in turn, is a copy of the Grande Armée of Napoleon Bonaparte, who was the first modern fascist. The Grande Armée and the Waffen-SS were echoes of the Roman legions, legions drawn from many parts of the world to herd or eliminate, by genocide and other means, entire peoples, and to control them, as the Waffen-SS did, as Napoleon set out to do with his Russian campaign of 1812. And we have in the United States today, especially in the United States, to some degree in Britain, and to a lesser degree in Europe, this tradition traced from the ancient Roman imperial legions through the revival of this by Napoleon Bonaparte with his Grande Armée, imitated directly and wittingly by Adolf Hitler in the form of the Waffen-SS and what it did. These are called, in military parlance in the United States since then, the Utopians. These were the people who were moving in 1960 and 61 into the Bay of Pigs. These were the people who were deployed in the environment in which President Kennedy was assassinated. These were the people in France and in the United States who were behind the attempted assassination of Charles de Gaulle in France, as President of France at that time, in 1962. These were the people behind the assassination of Mattei in Italy, the leader there, who've run all, these were the people behind the assassination of Martin Luther King, and so forth and so on. So we have, in a sense, a fascist movement in the United States, which is concentrated in certain sections of the military, which has a policy. The policy comes from a source which is really fascist, a source which is racist, the so-called Nashville Agrarians, so constituted in 1928. Around a group of grandchildren of the founders of the Ku Klux Klan. The leader of this was William Yandell Elliott, the leader of this group. William Yandell Elliott was a British agent by profession who taught government at Harvard. At Harvard, William Yandell Elliott created literally out of mud creatures such as Henry Kissinger, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and Samuel P. Huntington, and a whole array of other people. You have foundations such as the H. Smith Richardson Foundation, the Mont Pelerin Society, the Heritage Foundation, the American Enterprise Institute, and so Olin Foundation, this, on and on. These powerful foundations, tied to powerful financier interests in the United States, tied to powerful law firms, tied to powerful accounting firms, which actually run the United States, or at least a good deal of it. And these people are the backing for the policies which were consolidated under the succession of Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski as successive national security advisors to the presidents of the United States. These are the fascists. Their policy is what? Take the case of a close associate of Henry Kissinger, Michael Ledeen. Michael Ledeen in Switzerland, studying there, wrote a doctoral dissertation under the subject of universal fascism, Universal fascism is, Levine is an associate of Kissinger's. The policy of Brzezinski, the policy of Kissinger, has been consistently that identified by Levine as universal fascism. Universal fascism means, instead of thinking as Hitler did himself or Mussolini, that fascism was for fascism in one nation. These fellows said, no, that's not good enough. We're going to eliminate all nation states and have one world empire based on universal fascism, ruled by a military force in imitation of the Roman legions, in imitation of Napoleon Bonaparte's Grande Armée, and in fact, in explicit imitation of the Waffen-SS under the Hitler regime. They didn't say Waffen-SS because that was not considered good taste. But that's exactly, if you read the books, if you study the policies, if you see the deployments, if you see the current policies coming out of circles like Wolfowitz and Richard Perle or John McCain, the so-called Manchurian candidate, or Joe Lieberman, here you're looking at the image of universal fascism explicitly presented in these policies. And you see two parties, the Democratic and Republican Party, who is so infiltrated by these kinds of mentalities that they can do almost nothing competently this time. Since John McCain and Joe Lieberman met in the spring of this past year, the Democratic Party, which was trying to do something in the first quarter of year 2001, fell apart. It has done nothing good since, and has done a few things that are bad. The Republican Party is torn apart. It's got some of the worst of these fascists inside its own party, or their promoters. And the faction associated with Joe Lieberman, the DLC, Al Gore, and so forth, are the same thing. Now, this operation that happened on September 11th, you say, what was it? Well, what was its purpose? When you see a military operation or a quasi-military operation, you say, what is the mission? How do you understand a military operation? By looking at the mechanics? By counting the corporals? By seeing where the sergeants are drinking? No, you understand the military operation in terms of the mission to which it is dedicated. It is a force in motion. What is the motion? Where is it going? Well, it's obvious. It's the fight on the streets right now. The question is the United States going to get a legion from the United States and other countries recruited to invade Iraq, to invade Somalia, to invade Iran, to invade Korea, perhaps to invade China? Is that what the United States is doing? Well, that's the policy of Wolfowitz. That's the policy of many people pushing this Iraq policy. This is the policy of Zbigniew Brzezinski, the policy of clash of civilizations. This is the same kind of policy we ran into in European history between 1511 and 1648. In 1511, Venice, which was trying to turn back the progress made by humanity during the previous century, the progress which had been effected in France by Louis XI, and actually the echoes of Jeanne d'Arc, the progress which had been realized in England with the overthrow of Richard III by Henry VII, the England which had been beautified by the personality of Sir Thomas More, the England of Shakespeare later, that England, that France, that Italy, again were to be destroyed. The instrument was Venice. The power of Venice, which was still at that time an international imperial style of financier maritime power, which controlled Spain, which controlled the Habsburgs in Central Europe, which controlled Portugal, which had its agents in control in every one of these countries. So the Venetians orchestrated religious warfare from 1511 to 1648 throughout Europe, and plunged all of Europe, which had just come out of a dark age in the 14th century, plunged it back into what has been described by Trevor Roper and other historians as a new little dark age. Bloodshed and horror, nightmare, inquisitions, witchcraft, terror, sheer terror and mass murder. In 1648, Venice was defeated by the Treaty of Westphalia, which reestablished the principle of the modern sovereign nation state and declared that warfare heretofore must be in the service of the promotion and security of the sovereign nation state, and defined a clear rule between justified and unjustified warfare. Despite all the difficulties, that has remained up until a recent time, up until developments of the 20th century. The Treaty of Westphalia, 1648 treaty, ending the 30 Years' War, and actually ending a hideous period, a dark age in European civilization, from 1511 to 1648, the Habsburg horror of religious war finally brought to an end. Someone wants to return to that, to destroy the nation state, to globalize, to eliminate the nation state, to substitute the general welfare, the principle of our Constitution, for the notion of shareholder value, and that sort of thing. And that's what has happened. That's what's brought us to this point, September 11th. Why did it occur? Well, it occurred obviously because the system was disintegrating. Take the case of what happened to poor President George W. Bush. George W. Bush was down in Florida when September 11th struck. He obviously and others were targeted for potential death. Not just people in New York City and the Pentagon, but elsewhere, were targeted for death by a military coup operated by a faction inside the United States of the utopian model. Now, he had what's called an epiphany. Down in Florida, he said, one day he knows he's the president of the United States, and for a poor boy from Texas, that, you know, that's glory itself. I got all the power now. One day he feels like nothing. The next moment, he flies to base in Louisiana. He flies to Doomsday headquarters off at Nebraska. And during the trip to Nebraska, he gets a telephone call from the president of Russia. They have a conversation to which President Bush has referred on a number of occasions publicly, once with Putin just standing beside him as he recited the account. And George Bush had an epiphany. The president of Russia, the only other credible thermonuclear power on this planet, was backing up the president of the United States and saving his butt. Now that caused an epiphany in the other unlikely case of President George W. Bush. And it, for that moment, things began to go a little bit better. Bush went along with the policy, was scared stiff. His advisors obviously pushed him into this Afghan war, which never should have been started. This myth of Osama bin Laden, which is a complete fraud. No fact has ever been presented publicly in any forum in the world to give any backing whatsoever for the allegation that Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden caused the events of September 11th in the United States. Not a single bit of evidence was ever presented publicly. People said they had the evidence and they believed it, but they couldn't present it. You mean you're going to decimate half the world population and you can't tell them why? So the president was talked into that. But then they had the cute idea that by having a war in Afghanistan, since the United States has not got the ability to fight 1.5 wars, if it's all tied up in bombing Afghanistan, which is sort of a free target, almost no one's there, it's very difficult to find targets. Mountains and hills and fields, you might kill a few people in the process, but it's not much of a target. But it's certainly occupied. We lost every bomb we had practically. We began to run out of these missiles, these precision missiles. We were really crippled in our ability to conduct war anyplace else. So that postponed what the people behind September 11th wanted. What was the continued motion? It came out immediately. The motion is the United States must join with the IDF and Sharon of Israel to launch a global religious war. How are they going to launch the war? Very clear. From the moment that Sharon became the prime, before he became prime minister this time, Sharon authorized an attack on the third holiest place of Islam, Al-Haram al-Sharif. Now, if you start desecrating one of the sacred places of one of the major religions of the world, at the same time that you're killing Palestinian Arabs en masse in butchery, and launching attacks on other people saying that Islam is the menace, if you conduct that kind of idiocy, which Europe has seen before, in the Middle Ages and earlier, and saw it between 1511 and 1648, if you start that kind of fascist horror again, you're going to have a global religious war. Now, religious war has the peculiarity that it never really stops. Remember, religious war in Europe, which was launched again in modern times between 1511 and 1648, went on during all that period with a few interruptions, but it kept on going. The characteristic of European civilization for almost a century and a half was religious war. The horror that happened in the 30 Years' War between 1618 and 1648 is an example of religious war. When you start religious war, you're setting fire to civilization. And that's what these people were out to do. So you had a partnership between those forces which launched September 11th, that is the actual action, those forces which used September 11th as continued motion to push for global religious warfare, clash of civilizations, and those in Israel who admittedly now copied the methods of the Nazi SS in Warsaw against the Jewish ghetto, against the Palestinians in the Middle East. A war of genocide against Palestinians launched and mobilized with witting use of exactly the same methods used by Stroop, the Nazi commander in Warsaw, in murdering and butchering the Warsaw ghetto. This gives you a sense of the morality of the situation. And these three things go together. They're all of one piece. There is not one element to September 11th. There is the coup, the military operation, which is the detonator. There is the bomb, which is the clash of civilizations war, which is being pushed from then to the present time. Third, there's the crucial role of a fascist dictatorship in Israel, nominally headed by Sharon, to which Israelis are now revolting against in Israel. A fascist coup in Israel. And these three things are all coming together. Why'd they come together? Because the urgency of the economic and financial crisis. The present monetary and financial system is doomed. In its present form, it could never be saved. And what has happened during the past week, or the past 10 days approximately, as the Enron case began to unfold, you found, as I shall describe this shortly, a process in which the entire world financial system is unfolding. What is involved in Enron and Enron's counterparties, according to the best estimates of leading experts in various parts of the world, is this: more than $100 trillion of notional value of financial derivatives are in the process of imploding. We're not talking about a $35 billion collapse. We're talking about a potential notional collapse in financial derivatives of over $100 trillion just because of the connections of the Enron collapse. And that has been developing. When did it develop? Well, back in 1995-96, I did something which I'll refer to shortly. Made a forecast that we were entering a new phase of collapse of the post-1991 phase of the international monetary system. We are now heading to a chain reaction collapse, not tomorrow morning, but as a continuing process. This was the theme of my 1996 campaign for the presidential nomination of the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party said, no, it couldn't happen from Clinton on down. They said, it's not going to happen. Well, it happened. It was called the 1997 Asia crisis, which was not an Asia crisis. It was a crisis of the entire system, a crisis in the hedge fund system of the entire system. Then they said that was over. This was a result of Asian mistakes. It would never happen again. Then in August and September of 1998, we had the GKO crisis, the long-term credit management crisis, which almost brought down the entire U.S. system. They said, no, this is only temporary. It's a blip. We can fix it. So they got the Treasury Secretary of the United States and others together, and they decided they were going to run a plunge committee, a plunge protection committee. They were going to prevent this from ever happening again, and they began throwing money at rates never heard of before. They began making money, inventing it, at rates never dreamed of before, in order to try to paper over a collapse of a financial bubble. So what happened in the year 2000, coinciding with the collapse of the so-called new economy bubble. Remember, the new economy was set in motion in 1995, and it collapsed in the year 2000, and is disintegrating now. Collapsed in the spring of the year 2000. It was then pumped up by plunge protection money, but it collapsed again in 2001, and it was the collapse of the new economy bubble before September 11th, which caused the present financial collapse, leading to the Enron collapse and what's coming out of that. So now we have come to a point that the entire system from the top down is in the process of self-disintegration. This is a situation very much like, as I shall indicate, what happened in Germany, in Weimar Germany in 1923, when a system of bubble building, which had been existed in Weimar Germany for about more than a year, almost 2 years before then, which had not caused hyperinflation, suddenly in the June-July period of 1923, suddenly began to become hyperinflationary. And within less than 5 months from that point, the German Reichsmark ceased virtually to exist and was recreated by U.S. gold at a later point under the Dawes Plan.
You're listening to EIR Talks. We'll return in a moment with more of Lyndon LaRouche speaking to the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute on February 16, 2002. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with more of Lyndon LaRouche addressing the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute on February 16, 2002.
We're in a period like that in which the system is in the process of coming down. Now, let me shift gears, having said that much, and indicate what you have to know. I can tell you what the situation is. I can tell you what we in the world and the United States must do about the situation. You individually will have to decide what you're going to do about this for yourself. All I can do is describe the situation, and you have to decide how you're going to respond to it. Now, that's all that any forecaster, economic forecaster, could ever do. Now, most people don't understand forecasting. They think that somebody's going to predict an event, like a gypsy tea leaf forecaster who tells you when you're going to meet this mate on a certain day, right? And how it will happen to you. But I don't do that kind of forecasting, and never did. And people criticized me and said, but didn't you forecast? I said, no, I didn't forecast that. I didn't forecast that Hillary Clinton is going to marry Bill Clinton. That's a condition that existed in Bill Clinton, but I didn't forecast Hillary. So, you see, we live in a world in which we're of human beings. And the problem posed by forecasting is the way events go in the world, apart from astrophysical events and things of that sort, what happens in the world is predetermined by what? By the free will of human beings. So therefore, how do you forecast if human beings have what is called free will? So you do not forecast events. You forecast the conditions which will arise as a result of choices already made, conditions which will strike unless those choices are changed. You forecast a condition. You can then also say what your response to that condition should be. Not on a particular date, but in a time frame. And you can also forecast what will happen to you or them if they don't respond to that condition. It's like when the accountant goes says to Joe, the owner of the company, look, you keep this up, Joe, you're going to go bankrupt. Now, the accountant is not telling Joe when he's going to go bankrupt. He might be able to in some cases. Might be tomorrow morning. That would be an easy forecast to make. He knows the sheriff is already coming. But generally, you can forecast a condition, and you can forecast what that condition implies in terms of the response you must make, knowing that that condition is coming or has happened. That's all a forecaster can do that's competent. Anybody else who tries to tell you anything else is not a forecaster. They're a fake, because we're dealing with free will. And therefore, people can change their destiny by will. They cannot change it arbitrarily because there's a lawful process going on. They have to change by understanding the process in which they're gripped and understanding what their choices are under those conditions. They can even invent new choices. But those new choices they may invent will have to be fit the condition, which can be understood. And that's what I've done. In point of fact, in the past 35 years, actually 40, but I began to publicize my forecast more generally beyond a few narrow circles only about 1966-68 period, which they became rather celebrated in certain quarters. So that when 1971 hit, a lot of people knew that I had forecast what was going to happen, and it had happened. And nobody else had. Every other economist who had forecast anything in the United States or Europe had said, especially the United States, had said that something like August 1971 never could happen. The textbooks, they take the case of Economics 101, taught in most universities, including MIT, said that the built-in stabilizers would prevent a crisis of that nature from ever happening again. And virtually everyone said so. So for about 35 years, at least in a fairly broad and increasing public domain, I've been forecasting. And I have never made a mistake. I have never made a forecast which was not confirmed by events. Never. Not a single case. There are some people who try to say, well, didn't you forget that? I said, no, I didn't say that. Read what I said. I put it in writing repeatedly. Read it. What did I forecast? And I never made a mistake in forecasting, because I understand how to do it, and very few economists do. Now, therefore, I mention that now because I'm going to pull rank. Since all of you can have access, or should be able to get access to outside this door, to documentation which indicates this fact to be a fact, that I never made a mistake in an economic forecast. how can we understand how to deal with the present world problem? From the standpoint of my expertise in forecasting. Because your ability to analyze a situation is not some gypsy tea leaf reader's version. You analyze the situation by defining the process in which what you're studying occurs. In other words, if you're trying to psychoanalyze a rock, you're in trouble. So you have to know what you're investigating, the nature of what it is you're investigating, and then you are able to make reasonable forecasts. And you're able to make reasonable decisions, knowledgeable decisions. And that's what I'm going to get at. Now, the problem we have today, as I've already implied, is that we are living in a tragedy. Here we are in the United States. The United States, which at the close of World War II was almost all powerful. But we made a few mistakes. Roosevelt died and his body was not yet fully cold before Truman connived with Churchill to dump many of Roosevelt's intended policies. For example, Roosevelt had intended that at the conclusion of the war, that colonialism would come to a screeching halt. Not only would we end colonialism globally, that meant the Portuguese, the Spanish, the Dutch, the British, and the French colonies, but we'd also, not only the vestiges of colonialism, but that the United States, with the great power it had accumulated during the course of the war, would use that power as a leading force, not only to rebuild the shattered economies of continental Europe, but to launch great infrastructure development programs in places such as Africa, to give people in these areas which have been subject of colonialism, to give them the right to have the kind of economy that we had, the right to have access, real access, to the technology they needed. But that didn't happen. Truman immediately gave U.S. support to the British. And Truman and the British immediately, in that period, reestablished colonialism in areas of the world which had been destroyed. Among the Portuguese colonies, the French colonies, the Belgian colonies, the British colonies. Immediately, colonialism was reinforced at the point of bayonets. The Japanese army was taken out of prisoner of war camps in Indochina, given back its weapons and told to reoccupy Indochina until the British could take over and the French could come in and take over from the British. The Indonesia, which had won its freedom with the defeat of the Japanese, Dutch, supported by the United States and Britain, went in and conducted a bloody war to recolonize Indonesia, and so forth and so on. This was the policy. But there were some good things done. The good thing was the post-war monetary system as it affected Japan, as it affected the Americas, as it affected Western Europe. Under the post-war monetary system designed by Roosevelt, as presented at Bretton Woods, not Keynes, Roosevelt. Keynes did not design the post-war monetary system. Franklin Delano Roosevelt did. There's a fundamental reason for it. Keynes did not believe in national banking. Roosevelt did. We didn't have national banking, but we had a national banking policy which we used and intended to use. Under the post-war system, from 1945 to 1963 and slightly beyond, the United States and its partners in this post-war system, this Bretton Woods fixed monetary system, the gold reserve-based fixed currency rate. This system resulted in general improvements in the conditions of life of the nations and their populations in every part of the world which was a full participant. This was the benefit. From the middle of the 1960s, especially from 1971, the conditions of life of the people on the planet who had benefited from the post-war reconstruction prior to 1964, their conditions of life began to reverse. from 1971 on, there was a reversal, a significant one. There has been no net physical economic growth in the United States economy per capita since 1971-72. We've been using up infrastructure and similar kinds of things. We've been living on the fat off our own backs. The worst catastrophe that happened to us was called Jimmy Carter, Brzezinski's creation. And you have to know Brzezinski's crazy, and that Carter created him. Not God, but Brzezinski. Carter did more damage to the U.S. economy in 4 years than all other malicious presidents have done in the entire post-war period to date. Deregulation, the Volcker measures, controlled disintegration of the economy, all policies designed under the direction of Brzezinski, ruined the economy, the United States. We've been going downhill. Then, 1989, 1991, the Soviet system was disintegrating. So the Anglo-American interests, which are behind these policies, anti-Roosevelt policies, decided they're going to build a world empire. They're going to eliminate the nation state as an institution. They're going to use universal free trade, globalization, deregulation, new economy, and similar kinds of swindles in order to create a worldwide permanent empire run by an Anglo-American force, which would be essentially military in nature, like the Roman legions, or like what the Waffen-SS had intended to become, was intended to become under the Nazis. This has been the policy. Under these conditions, from 1977 to the present, there has been a catastrophic collapse in the living standard, in the share of national income, of the lower 80% of the family income brackets of the United States. There has been a similar destruction, which has occurred in Europe, especially since 1989. There have been countries which we said are the new emerging markets. They were not. They are essentially a new form of colonialism, where some people are employed in industries of runaway shops, running away from Europe and the United States, shipping back to the United States, and we don't pay for it. We borrow money from the world to pay for things that we consume that we no longer produce. In the process, a vast bubble was set up, a financial bubble. And that's what has exploded right now. Now, what I indicate is, the point is this. We had a system that did work. It was neither just nor perfect. The system of the post-war system from 1945 to 1963-64. It was not a perfect system, it was not a just system, but it worked from an economic standpoint. There was an improvement in the living standard per capita of the people. There was hope. There was hope that this could be continued, that the benefit could be extended to include those who had been left behind in the process. But it worked. With Nixon's meeting with the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi, in 1966, in starting his campaign based on a pro-neo-Confederacy campaign for the president, the Nixon campaign of 1966 became a determining factor in the policy shaping of the United States, and we began to go to hell. And Nixon's decision of 1971 was an inflection point in this. And we've been going to hell ever since. And the institutions which I mentioned before, such as the Mont Pelerin Society and Heritage Foundation, American Enterprise Institute, Smith Richardson Foundation, the Olin Foundation and Institute, and so forth, these institutions have controlled U.S. policy in the way I've indicated, and they destroyed the U.S. economy. So therefore, the problem today is, how do we reverse that? How do we get back to a policy which worked without necessarily replicating the injustices or the other shortcomings in the system? How do we extend the policy to include the entire world not merely some parts of the world, while leaving the others into the vestiges of neocolonialism and colonialism. Now, just to give you an indication of this, forecasting. How do we forecast? You have two kinds of forecasts, of economic forecasts, competent forecasts. One are called long-range forecasts. By long-range forecasts, I mean forecasts of usually more than 10 to 15 years, and usually 25 to 50 years. That is, you take the conditions that under which an economy is operating, a nation is operating, and by extrapolating from those conditions, you can see what the trends are with that economy, its ups and its threatened downside down the line. We talk about forecasting, long-range forecasting, talk about a generation, 25 years. What's 25 years? 25 years is the period from the birth of a child until the biological maturity of that child at about 25, which coincides in a society which is well-developed with a good educational system to the professional maturation of a future professional. It takes about 25 years investment in a child to bring that child to the kind of maturity which we should expect for every child in the United States here and out. That's a cycle. You have to invest in that child for 25 years. Maybe the child makes a contribution along the line, but net, you must continue to invest. The family must invest. The nation must invest in the form of schools, the form of educational systems, the form of healthcare systems, mass transportation systems, all these things. These are investments which are necessary to carry our next generation of children from birth to about 25 years before they can begin to pay back. To realize the investment in that child once reaching 25, it takes another 30, 40 years of work by that adult to replicate what society's investment in them was and to bring society to a higher level. Therefore, the basic element in policy shaping, starting with things like education and health care, which begin with the birth of the child or even before, is the cycle, the long cycle. In fact, we find that in most cases that in the development of nations, it takes two generations, not one, to realize a long-term fundamental objective of improvement. One generation is developed. Its development enables it to contribute to the development of the next generation. So you have a cycle of essentially 50 years. It's a time you must think ahead in economics. And the shortest period you must think in terms of is 25 years, one generation. But really think ahead, long-term thinking, is two generations. Now we can predict to a great degree of relevance what the conditions or changes in conditions will be as a result of policies we are adopting today on a well-organized society 25 years ahead. That we can know. Therefore, when we look at what we're doing today, don't look at what we are doing from moment to moment. Look at what the effect is of what we've decided to do on what the conditions will be up to 25 years ahead. So you're thinking in terms of basically 25 years, 50 years. You're thinking in terms of medium-term effects, like investments in a machine tool, or investments in buying a house, or invest other kinds of investments. See, these take, say, 5 to 10 years. You're also thinking about how you manage in the 2 to 3 year short-term period as well. This is where the economist who's competent thinks. Now, the economist does not think in money terms. An economist thinks in physical terms. Don't tell me what the price of a railroad ticket is. Tell me, does the train work? Can I get there? Will I be able to board it when I need to? And what is it going to cost in terms of the available resources of society to maintain that railroad? I don't want to know what the prices are. I'll get to the prices later. I want to know we've got a system that works. If it works, we'll pay the prices and we'll set the wages and so forth accordingly to meet these prices. So that's the way you think about an economy. Now, what happens in an economy, which is important, we'll come to that next. But first then you get to this question of the short term. In the short term, since the conditions we're going to reach will be chiefly the result of long-term cycles, you have to locate the possibilities you're going to face, the opportunities and challenges you're going to face. You have to, in the short term, you have to look at it from a long-term standpoint. Where are we going? Take, for example, as Richie Freeman will deal with in a paper he's working on, the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority. The Tennessee Valley Authority was one of the greatest jobs ever done in the United States. It transformed that whole section of the United States, all the tributaries. It was the basis for a lot of things that happened during World War II in terms of industrial capability. It is a benefit still today. Al Gore would never have crawled out of the mud if his father hadn't benefited from the TVA. He'd still be down there as a mudworm or something. So these kinds of projects are the things that long-term investments which determine the future possibilities or lack of possibilities for the conditions of life of a population. That's long term. So therefore you try to situate what is the relationship of your short term behavior or somebody else's behavior in terms of this cycle. Now in that case, you cannot exactly predict what's going to happen, because what Joe Blow decides to do within the cycle is going to determine exactly what happens. I mean, a corporation goes crazy and they fire all their employees. Well, you don't know that's going to happen. But you can understand the event. You can understand how to respond to it. So therefore, you have to make a distinction between long-term forecasting, in which you can be very precise, at least within economic policy-making decisions, and short-term, which you cannot be precise in terms of events or what's going to happen, but you can be precise in defining the conditions to which you must be prepared to respond. Now, what happened is this. Give an example of this, the first chart, the first curve, just to get an indication of this. Now, this is what I had an appearance of an invitation in the autumn of 1995 to participate in the Vatican Conference on Healthcare. And as my contribution to my hosts, I submitted a paper in which I said, well, this is something I'm going to present anyway. Let me present it here. It may be useful to them to indicate what was going on with the world economy. All right, now, this is very simply, this is the state of affairs in which the United States has been operating during this period. That we have been on a downslide in physical terms, that is, measured in physical quantities, as anybody who happens to be inhabiting the lower 80% of family income brackets knows. This is the way things have been going. For the family standard of living in physical terms, such as health care, for example, has been going down. So this curve is going not only going down, but it's accelerating. It's actually hyperbolic. At the same time, the so-called market values, Wall Street market values, have been galloping up until recently. That the way this financial aggregate system is, the financial aggregate is going how? By stealing from people. That is, a corporation does a cost reduction. It pays people less. It steals. Or it imports from a foreign country from cheap labor and steals. Therefore, the physical economy per capita of the United States has been decaying, especially for the lower 80% of family income brackets, while the financial value per capita of monetary aggregate, that is financial aggregate, has been increasing per capita. The stock market has been going up. Everybody knows the stock market is going up. Great. The economy is fine. So the patient is dying, but the fever is rising. Now, this is done in part by an increasing reliance on pumping and printing money directly and indirectly into the economy through the Federal Reserve System, for example, or by borrowing Japanese yen at 0% interest rate percent. So this has been feeding the growth of financial aggregates, have been growing because of the looting of the physical economy which is then turned into profit. And by the leverage on growth in financial values by monetary pumping. All right, now let's go to the second case and see what the point is here. Now, this is the condition which the United States economy reached during the spring of year 2000. In this point, the amount of financial aggregate which had to be poured into the economy under the Clinton program of plunge protection, the amount of aggregate that had to be poured in to keep the stock market and related financial markets from collapsing exceeded the amount of endangered financial assets which needed to be rolled over. This is exactly what happened to Germany in June, July of 1923, in which the German bank had to print money more rapidly than was accounted for by the amount of assets it was rolling over. And that led to hyperinflation. So at this point, the U.S. financial system in the spring and summer of 2000 went into a hyperinflationary mode.
You've been listening to EIR Talks, presenting Lyndon LaRouche speaking to the President's Day Conference of the Schiller Institute on February 16, 2002. To replay this program or to read the full transcript of the conference, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EIR Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.